So our main speaker for this evening, Tom P. from Dana Point.
I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Grateful to be sober. Grateful to know that I'm sober by the grace of a power greater than me. I've always got to remember that. I'm grateful also to know I'm sober because of the love that I find in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come in here expecting to find an organization committed to a spiritual way of life that's organized around these principles of unity that we call the traditions. And I've been able to travel and do lots of things in life, and I've never seen an organization organized like, and I love the reading that he just did about how important it is that we be unified because of the job that we have to do. And the job that we have to do is to carry a message to the still suffering alcoholic, and they're everywhere, and we can do better. And we do better. And I know that for myself and the people I work with and the people I'm close to, we struggle with that issue. And how can we do that better? And we're an organization that's committed to grow. And we know that. We're not committed to perfection. We're committed to progress. I'm a bit heavy. My father was put into hospice yesterday, and that's a good thing. I think it's the right thing for him, but at the same time, there's sadness, and there's I'm complete with them because of Alcoholics Anonymous. A couple years ago, we were in at a family reunion. I'm the oldest of six kids, and so there's lots of grandkids, and we had a family reunion up in Colorado, and it was me and him sitting in a house together, and this was probably 4 or 5 years ago, and he was still pretty lucid, and he was doing a crossword puzzle, and he looks over to me and says, "Hey, Tom, what day is this?" And I said, "That's June 10th, Dad. Why?" And he goes, "Isn't that the day that doctor and that stockbroker got together?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, we call this Founders Day." And because I was just thinking about it when I said, "Why do you ask?" He says, "Tom, I want you to know that's a big day. That's a big day." So I'm grateful that I can be up here, share my experience, strength, and hope with you, participate in your primary purpose, which is to carry a message to the still-suffering alcoholic through the structure of this group. Thank you for everybody who serves here. Ryan, thank you for sharing. Welcome to our new friends that stood up and introduced yourselves, and the ones that didn't, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I pray that what you can find here is the path to an open mind, to let go of those fixed ideas and those need to know ideas that trap and hold us in our life that we can't get free of. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the life that it's given me. I love the way that I like Ryan. I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic, in that I wouldn't have found what I found here if I hadn't have been able to go through the horror and pain that I went through. I got sober at almost age 44, and that was September 6, 2001. My first drink was in 1970. I was 12 years old. I'll tell a little bit about what prelude to that drink, that drunk, because it relates to my dad. And he was a fighter pilot. He was flying a wild weasel pilot flying an F-105. Fighter planes in Vietnam, and it was a plane that was probably ill-suited for the mission they were using it for, because half of the planes were getting shot down. The Russians had just introduced some pretty serious SAM technology, and so they were knocking half the planes out, and so half of my dad's friends were ending up dead, POW or MIA. And in our house, we were living with my grandmother in Chicago at the time. The year that I remember most vividly was 1968. 1968 was a kind of a crazy year. I was 11 years old at the time. Robert Kennedy gets assassinated. Martin Luther King gets killed. There's riots going on in Detroit and Chicago. And all this stuff is being shown on the televisions. We had these little old black and white televisions, but I remember all this stuff. And so I'm seeing the peace marches, and I'm getting conflicted because my dad and his friends were my heroes, and I'm seeing them kind of like vilified as through the peace marches. But at the same time, you know, what would happen is one of my dad's friends would end up dead, POW or MIA, and one of my mom's friends' husbands would be that person. And so we'd come home from school, and mom, you know, we started to learn there are certain times you just don't ask what's going on. Because mom might be at this kind of, you know, crazy crying. She might be drunk. She might be just quiet. And so we just kind of just knew. And once a month or so, it would seem. So I'm personally, as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old, I'm just conflicted. I'm laying in bed at night in this little room with two bunk beds, four boys live in one room, and I'm the oldest. And I'm biting a pillow at night so that they can't hear me crying, because my job is to be, you know, to be the man of the house, you know. Stiff upper lip, keep your shoulders back, and that's all the stuff that I was supposed to do that to make my dad proud. And I knew I couldn't do that. I would walk on the school ground, and I knew that the other kids could see the fact that I've been crying all night, and I couldn't look them in the face. And I just would get, this stuff just kept building up and building up. And I didn't have words to describe it then, and in fact, it's hard to describe those now. You know, Bill says no words can describe the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of, you know, no words describe how bad it gets for us. And so it's hard to talk about the spiritual world. Dad comes home safe, and we end up in this great assignment in Hawaii. Part one of the challenges I grew up with, and I grew up knowing I was loved, knowing I was wanted, and I knew that all the time. We did drink a little too much in our family. I'm one of three children in our family who are sober. There's another one that needs to be sober. So four of us six ended up as pretty hopeless alcoholics. And then we've got a bunch of children of ours and my parents' grandchildren that are in the same boat. So that stuff's all going on. But that seemed normal. You know, that's just what normal people do. In fact, you know, what Ryan was talking about, my first drunk involved me being in Hawaii. And I meet some new friends, and, you know, meeting new friends was always kind of hard, moving every 2, 3, 4 years, just always having to go to that thing, and it's kind of nervous going, but, you know, I'd do what I needed to do. I'd be who I thought you needed me to be in order to be part of the deal, and they asked me if I wanted to go steal some booze from the officers' club and get drunk in the park. And I said, yeah, you know, it seems like a good idea. I had drank before, but it was always sips off the beers and stuff. Since I was the oldest son, I got to hang out and listen to the stories they told and the daring and the flying and the stuff that they would do. And I would just admire that stuff. And so when I had that first drunk, it did something for me that it would continue to do for the next 31 years. For the next 31 years, I would be blinded by what I thought alcohol was doing for me, that I couldn't see what it did to me. And what it did for me that night was it put me in touch with my closest friends. I had just met them, but they were the ones I was going to run through life with. And it gave me that sense that, you know, that conflict that had been inside of me, that kind of wrestling, that unsolvable conflict, it just disappeared. It was okay. I became okay with who I was. Kind of a skinny, nervous, buck-toothed, big-eared kid, and I became okay with that. That stuff all just kind of went away, and I knew I was the coolest kid on the block. I began to steal right away to get booze, because we found out that in the corpsman's barracks, they had a vending machines that had beer in them. And there were a quarter, so I was stealing lots of quarters to... Because you could get them, and we would get chased out of there a lot. But that was our weekend things. We'd go, and then we'd go watch movies or something. And I continued to progress. My first decade was, from that first drunk at 12 to probably age 21, 22, was, like, I remember pinball machines, foosball tables, rock and roll bars, keggers in the field, a lot of wrecked cars, but lots of insane laughter. And sitting with friends and having those just deep moments. Bill calls them moments sublime. You know, I just those kind of moments where you're just connected with other humans in a way that I thought I could never do. And I knew that what allowed that to happen was alcohol. I knew that alcohol was the secret decoder ring to life. I also ended up with a bit of trouble. You know, towards the end of that stuff, I'm starting to have to give, because the more you start drinking and the other stuff that goes along with it, it costs money, and I start running out of money, so I'm having to compromise myself to get money to take care of, you know, what's going on, and I'm starting to give plasma to drink, and so I'm in college and not doing good in college, but I get kicked out of the University of Colorado in Boulder because I get caught stealing booze from the liquor store, and there's a legal case involved, and so I get, and I'm, I know that I was also kicked out because I didn't pass any courses. There was that part. And so I end up going to work. I became a construction hod carrier laborer in the masonry business. I did that for about 2-3 years. Earned a lot of money by cash, and that really helped. And we were able to sell things and became a daily drinker. And at one point, I end up in a fight. That was another thing. I was getting in fights. I was wrecking cars and getting in fights. And not because I was a tough guy, but I just seemed to want to. I attracted fights. So this one, I don't remember anything about it. I remember going to a bar in Tempe, Arizona in the afternoon and coming to in a hospital, and they're wiring my jaw shut. Turns out, my brother tells me, because I don't remember, what ended up, a lot of the times, I have no idea what happened, but what humiliated me was the stories that people told me about what I had done, the embarrassing, humiliating things that I could not believe I would do, but... And I'm told I did it, and today I believe it. Back then, I didn't believe it. I knew they were lying to me. But this time, I knew they weren't lying because they were wiring my jaw shut. And turns out I had jumped into a big fight that was going on and got knocked out and was on the ground. Somebody just swings their booted foot, and they just kick me right in the face, and they break this bone here. And so this bone is flapping, and so they wired it shut. And... Now I'm gonna drive back to Colorado from Arizona to Colorado for a Thanksgiving, and now I've got my jaw wired, and I'm drinking in Flagstaff, and somebody has some mushrooms, and I think, you know, that might help. So I unwired my jaw, and I went on to Colorado, and I ended up losing all the teeth and the bone. They had to rebuild all that stuff over the years, that experience prompted me to recognize that there was something wrong. So I realized that what I needed to do was get married. So I got my brother's girlfriend pregnant, and and we started a life together. Decade two is this beautiful life that's supposed to be taking place. You know, I end up getting an accounting degree. I get a job for an accounting firm in Tucson, Arizona. I'm working for a Big Eight accounting firm. I become a CPA, and so I'm, you know, the first year is pretty good. We're happy. We've got a child. We're paying all our bills, and but then things start slipping, and I'm not sure what happened. But I was able to hold it together for you. I would go on binges once in a while, but it seemed like I could get it together for the family. But I couldn't keep it together. And so over the next 10 years, what ends up happening is, you can imagine, she ends up, because I'm a hopeless alcoholic, and it gets worse and worse and never gets better. And at the end of 10 years, she's very emotionally sick, and she ends up having to get treatment for herself to deal with the sickness that's come upon her as far as dealing with an alcoholic like me. And so she goes into a facility, and she's there for 90 days, and what she comes out with is the understanding that she does not want to be married to me anymore, so she divorces me. And by then, I've joined up with my brother. We formed a construction company, and we're doing pretty good in commercial construction. We're starting to accumulating some assets and wealth, and I'm getting divorced now, and I don't want to get divorced. I don't think it's a good idea, but so I start fighting over the divorce, and I fight over custody of the kids, because that was the one leverage I could have, because since she had been in a mental facility, and so what I do is I start using my skills of manipulation and deceit to force her into a place where, you know, I win. Over that time frame, I end up getting 5 DUIs, and I keep this is a 2-year period. I'm continuing the cases. They're good. They're in different counties all over the place. So I've got all these different cases, As long as I can keep the balls in the air, I'm fine on this thing. I've got different attorneys. They're always being continued. Nobody ever gets to find out that these things are taking place, because the one thing that would have compromised my position was my alcoholism, because that's what she kept saying, and I just kept denying it. And when I got awarded primary physical custody of the kids, I watched the life drain out of her face because she couldn't prove it. The good news is God began to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. God, I believe God has always been present, you know, but I'm, my, what does the book say, blocked by worry, or worship, glamour, the things within, I'm blocked from that power. And what ends up happening is, 2 months after I get awarded primary custody of the kids, I get sentenced to my first 6 month stint in a correctional facility. Yep. Oops. So I get to call her and say, you know, this arrangement where we trade the kids every week, and I'm not going to be able to live up to my end of the bargain, and I'm going on a little vacation. And so I go away for 6 months, and she gets the kids. So I get out. Now I've no longer got, and this is the last decade, I've no longer got a wife, I no longer got kids, and all I've got left is a business that's running pretty good, because it does even better when I'm in jail. And and so it's like somebody had lit a turbocharger in me, and I just kind of went way off the deep end. I'm drinking all the time. I can't stop drinking, and I end up getting 7 DUIs. I end up getting arrested 48 times. I used to think insanity was what happened to me when I drank. I want to tell you that September 5th, 2001, I put a rope around my neck because I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take breaking the promises I was making to myself and to everybody else. And I sat on a stool, and I knew that when I passed out, because by this time I'm up 5, 6, 7 days in a row, and I'm sleeping for 2 or 3 days in a row. And this was the pattern for the last 5 years of my life. I knew that when I went out, I wouldn't have to deal with this stuff anymore, because some of the stuff that happens to us along the way is not only what happens to us, but what happens to the people that we love. You know, I can't get those faces out. I can't get the look of my daughter's face. Whereas one point I had I knew what I needed was some father-daughter time. And I was restricted from seeing the kids, so I went and kidnapped one of my daughters so I could take her down in the mountains in southern Colorado. I would teach her how to fish. I would do the kinds of things that I knew a father was supposed to do. It had been modeled for me and my father, and I wanted to have that experience with my daughter because I knew that would fix me. But I'm a hopeless alcoholic. I can't stop. I'm drinking and using all the time. And I've got her down there, and we're having a good time. We're playing with the dogs, and I go out, I don't know, for day 6, day 7, and I'm out in this little beat-up RV that I used to follow the Grateful Dead in, and I was doing some, I was at least responsible in some parenting because I kept the doors locked so I wouldn't lose her. Anyway, I pass out, and I don't know how long I'm out. I'm out day 2, but when I come to, my eyes open, and they startle this little 8-year-old. And she jumps back, and I see her, and she's got her dirty, matted face, tear-streaked face, hair matted and dirty, and she can squeak out. She just jumps back and squeaks out one thing. She says, "Dad, can I at least have some dinner?" You know, those kinds of things, I can't run fast enough to get away from. I can't drink hard enough to make those memories go away. And when you compound them over and over and over again, it's something that at some point, the most sane thing I could think of is to take my own life. I used to think what's meant by insanity is what happens to me after I start drinking and using. I used to think it was insane that I could get arrested 48 times, that I'd have 7 DUIs. I used to think it was insane that I would try to chop a telephone pole down in the front of my house because I had seen an alien spaceship hooked up to it, and I knew that I was saving the world, and that I used to think it was insane that I would have conversations with the dead members of the Grateful Dead and they could convince me that I was to be in the reincarnation of Jerry Garcia and I would devote 5 years of my life to this project. But today I know that none of that stuff's insane. It's not insane for me to wreck cars. It's not insane for me to ruin a marriage. It's not insane for me to give my kids away once I take a drink. Once I take a drink, it sets in motion, because I've got a body that's biochemically different than normal people, it sets in motion a process where I get thirsty. That's what happens to me when I drink, is I get thirsty. And the thirstier I get, the more I drink. And alcohol does what it's supposed to do. It impairs my judgment, it impairs my motor skills, and over time it warps everything about me. Everything about who I am becomes warped, and I become a slave to alcohol. And I think that I'm drinking because I want to drink. I think I'm drinking, I'm kicked out of a bar and I'm trying to bust the windows out to get back in the bar to get one more drink. And I'm in a blackout. I don't remember any of that stuff. This is just what they're telling me, and that's how I got all the blood, all the cuts on my hand. There was some proof to what they said, but I don't remember a thing about it. You know, it says in the big book, and I quote the big book a lot, because I found in the big book that by their experience, things I can relate to, ways to get to articulate it, conditions that I couldn't give words to, whether it was how bad it got or how good it got or how it even happened. There's a line that says, while our opinion as lay people may mean little, and this is the opinion that the doctor gives about what happens to us when we start drinking. He calls it a phenomenon of craving, an allergy, that it manifests as a craving. An abnormal reaction to a food or a substance is what an allergy is. He says, while our opinion as lay people may mean little, as ex-problem drinkers, it explains many things for which we could not otherwise account. What it explained for me is why, in a blackout, why am I always getting in trouble in a blackout? I've already gotten what I'm looking for. I could get what I was looking for at about drink three. At about drink three, it would settle in. The peeling wallpaper would be just perfect on the bar. The music in the jukebox was the perfect music playing at that time. I had the perfect stroke to play pool. About drink three. It lasts about, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes. But I can never just stay at drink three. I'm always out there at drink 30. You know, I'm supposed to drink 8 of these a day. And I haven't even drank any of this yet. This doesn't trigger the allergy. This is way better for me. I understand my life will be much better. My health will be much better. I know that. I can't even get there to get it open. No, it's all right. But if that was a Heineken, pretty sure I'd have about 30 of them. A fifth of tequila, maybe a couple bottles of wine, and this is probably, you know, I've got a big pocket of cocaine in them, and I'm in that, and that's what's going to, and what it does to me is exactly what it's supposed to do. You know, so when I drink, what follows that is not insane, it's 100% predictable. What's insane is that it always happens when I'm completely sober. I'm in a treatment center for the first time. I'd had, you know, I had a lot of legal cases, and I discovered at some point. I ended up while I was still drinking, I did 2 years in correctional facilities. After I got sober, I turned myself in. I did 6 more months. But I discovered that if you go to these treatment centers, you get a little break from the justice system. They won't call you. So you get 30 days, and nobody, you don't have to answer any mail. It's a good thing. So I'm at this place in Tucson. It's nice. There's filet mignon, horseback riding. I think this is pretty good. Nice 30 days. But they brought my kids down, and my parents, and my ex-wife and her husband. They all came in, and they got, like, indoctrinated by these people, and they were trained on how to attack me. And what they did was, with poetry and pictures and stories, told me how important I was in their life and how much hurt and pain I caused in their life and how they wished that I wouldn't do it. And I got it. I got it. In Bill's story, it says, I had made many a sweet promises, but this time I meant business. And this time I meant business with them. I'm not doing this anymore. I remember that so clearly, how deeply I knew that I would never drink again. That I'm going to do what they... And so we plan this big Christmas party. I'm going to get out on the 13th of December and head back to Colorado Springs. And so I'm in Tucson, Arizona. The job is get me to the bus station. This is, you know, anytime it involves an alcoholic, you know there's going to be a twist. Get me to the bus station to Phoenix, Phoenix Airport to Colorado Springs Airport, easy job. Well, I'm in the bus station in Tucson waiting for the bus, and I notice that there's a cooler, and it's got Heineken's in it. I think, man, what a big month this has been. We've come a long way. I can't wait to get back there and have this Christmas party. You know, I'm going to have a beer because this is a long drive on a bus, and I need to take the edge off because I've done some good, solid work, and so I have a beer. I wasn't aware at this time that I've got the phenomenon of craving. I have no idea that one beer is going to trigger everything else that follows. I drink the rest of the beers. I don't get on the bus to Phoenix. I get on a bus to Tijuana. I'm just going to take a little detour. I end up at the Crystal Inn and the Mission Pier. I think that's what it is. I've got a kilo of cocaine, a whole bunch of new friends. And until they kick us out. And 10 days later, it dawns on me. I've been to Las Vegas. I've been to Reno. I've been flying around because they used to keep cash in casino cages just for these rainy day type of opportunities. So I call my ex-wife back, and after she's done screaming at me, she says, the judge has taken any other parental rights you had remaining left. We thought you were dead. You've been filed as a missing person. Oh, and by the way, your daughter who planned, this is the little 8-year-old, she was 9 at the time, she planned this Christmas party, and she sat out on the curb waiting for you. And this is in December, and she said, we went to the door every 15 minutes telling her that you weren't coming, and she kept turning around saying, he's coming, he's just buying us presents. You know, there's a line in the big book about we warp the lives of our blameless children, disgust our friends and employers, sadden our wives and our parents, you know, annihilate all things worthwhile in life. That's my story. I annihilated all things worthwhile in life. There wasn't anything that I wouldn't walk through once I got going. I wouldn't do it for the first drink, but once I've had the first drink, I'm giving away everything near and dear to me. The most insane thing I've ever done in my life, I was 100% sober every single time. I was 30 days sober that day I picked up that. And I've got, the big book says at certain times we will be unable to bring forth with sufficient force into my consciousness. Means that it doesn't get up here where it matters. The memory of suffering, misery, and humiliation. I am without effective mental defense against the first drink. That's my insanity. And I can't fix that. Now maybe, why don't we shock them to death? Why don't we do a lobotomy? Why don't we starve them? All that stuff has been tried. And in 1934, after Bill had been prescribed as a hopeless alcoholic, his wife had been told that he's not going to make it, get his affairs in order, 6 to 9 months, this man's going to be dead or insane. Something happened. And he started telling people about what had happened to him. And in that process, he discovered that what we can do is we accept some spiritual principles that are outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're this is the Cliff Notes version. This isn't the deal. The deal's in the book. The book gives me a concise, precise set of instructions that allows me to go through a process that will produce a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. It will bring about a profound alteration in my reaction to life. With that, whatever it was that alcohol treats, it's not there anymore. We cease fighting everything and everyone, including alcohol, because by this time, sanity has returned. I've got to go through a process that's going to restore me to sanity. Now, why can't I get there on, like, just acting better? Why do I need to rely on a power greater than myself? I've got time to tell this. I was a seeker, and I believe all of us are seekers. And I think that's a big part of the effect produced by alcohol, is it puts us in a different place. Carl Jung, in his exchange of letters with Bill Wilson, said that what it's like, and he uses the psalm, as the deer longs for running streams, is that we long for something in the nature of union with the divine. That's what he wrote about when in the letters with Bill. And that's what it seemed to me that alcohol did. It seemed to me like, because I would go to church. We went to church every Sunday. I had a good example of spirituality. My grandmother, who when her brother got shot down in World War II and paratrooped into Germany and got taken POW, my grandmother started going to Mass every day. She went to Mass every day until February 19th of 2002 when she died. Every day she went to Mass from that point on. I had good examples of people who are honorable, righteous, virtuous, spiritual people. And I tried to be like that. I tried to do that stuff, but I couldn't do it. In 1996, I went to India. I had been part of a, I had met some people. We had done some like this breakthrough work where you, you know, I've been trying to do all these methods to try to get free of my drinking. I even went at one point, I was part of a Buddhist, it was a Buddhist Gurdjieff program up in Boulder, Colorado. And it was involved weekly meditations with an instructor. And then once a month at a commune, you go up and you work in the gardens and do this. One time I'm at the meditation with my therapist instructor, and he goes, "Are you drunk?" I said, "Oh yeah." I said, "I go to the bar and then I smoke crack in the car right before I come in here. It is fantastic." He said, "This isn't going to work," and he kicked me out. But anyway, those people, one of them had led this event for one of the nieces of the Dalai Lama, and so. Because I was good friends with him, he says, "You want to go to India? And if you pay for me, you can go to India." So I paid for him to go to India. And so there's 14 of us, and we know we're going to get to meet the Dalai Lama. And so what I started doing, we were leaving on Easter, is I started for 6 weeks prior to that going to Mass every day. There was other reasons, because of the church, the school where my kids went to, I would go to the Mass at that school. So I'd at least get to see my kids. I couldn't talk to them, but I could see them. Because they couldn't keep me out of the church, and I'd go to the Mass, and I would do the stuff, but I'm drinking and using every day. I'm not stopping. So I go there, and we think, well, what we'll do is we'll see if we can meet Mother Teresa. We'll go to Calcutta first. We went to Nepal, Calcutta, then traveled through India, and then went up to Dharamsala, where we finally meet the Dalai Lama. Well, I'm in this chapel. The way you meet Mother Teresa back then is you go to the Mass in the morning. At where the nuns are, and then she greets people afterwards. But she had broke her collarbone, and she hadn't been at Mass. And so we went on a whim, just thinking she might show up. And she wasn't there when we got there. But I'm in the front kneeling. Their chapel is like this concrete room. There's no pews. It's just one table, and it's all concrete floor. And I have a breakdown experience. Tears are coming out, and I'm just having, you know. And I'd had these experiences before, but none of them ever kept me sober. I look around, and there's a wheelchair. And it turns out it's Mother Teresa. So I'm kneeling next to Mother Teresa. The Mass gets over. She goes to the door, and she's agreed to meet some people. And so we meet, and I sit down right next to her. But she agrees to give an interview. She's going to give an interview to an Argentinian film crew. She agrees to give the interview, and I sit down on the ground right next to her. So for 2.5 hours, I sit next to Mother Teresa while she gives this interview. And I have this most profound experience. And I know that I'm in the presence of the sacred, that I am in the midst of a holy person. And I had these powerful experiences. It gets all over. Everybody goes on their way. You know, what everybody does, all the visitors, the tourists that come to visit her. You go help with the lepers. Well, I had another thought. And I said, well, I wonder if I could get on at the Calcutta Country Club. So I left them. An hour after I had met Mother Teresa, I'm drinking scotch at the Calcutta Country Club. Can't keep me sober. Meet the Dalai Lama, have this powerful experience. We're in this place called the Chonar House for 9 days. It's a different experience. It's political. There's some security issues. So, you know, I'm drinking wine in the place because everybody else does it. I'm not getting out of control. I'm, you know, because I'm going to meet the Dalai Lama. And we get to spend the afternoon with him, have this powerful experience in the presence of holiness, knowing I'm in a sacred place. And leave there the next morning, and I'm going up on a hike with the guy, and the Sherpa turns to me and he says, "You want to hit acid?" I said, "You know I do." So I've always been a seeker. And none of... and with the best of what the world has to offer, it can't touch my alcoholism. But I come to you. What ends up happening is September 5th, 2001, I don't kill myself and I end up by a set of circumstances at a facility in Chandler, Arizona. And they don't care about what I'm doing. They ask why I'm there. I try to tell them about reincarnating as Jerry Garcia, and I get about 45 seconds into it, and he says, "You're full of shit." He hurts my feelings. I'm crying weeping over in the corner. And the next lady shares about why she's there, and she shares about finding her dad dead on her basement floor when she was 13, and then she shares about the next 39 years of her life. and about what brought her to that place. And this place was no longer filet mignons and horseback riding. This was there's crack transactions taking place in the alley. They said to me when I came in, you're going to meetings every day and you're going to work through the big book and you're going to work with one of the spiritual advisors we give you. If you don't like that, these doors aren't locked, you're leaving. And that was my welcome. And so I'm sitting there listening to this lady tell about her life of 39 years of hopelessness, of despair, of the stories that we all live. And she describes what it was like to be a woman alcoholic on the streets of San Diego. What it meant, what it was like for her to be a prostitute, selling herself to get the next drink, the next hit. And what it was like to be raped, to be beaten, all that stuff. And as she told her story, her humanity touched my humanity. Her brokenness touched my brokenness. And something inside of me gave up. And what gave up was any belief that I could do anything different. That I was no different than her dad. And the gift I was going to give my daughters was the same gift that her dad had given her. And that someday my daughters might be sitting someplace telling that same story. And I knew there was nothing I could do about it. And something inside of me gave up. I knew that I had lost the battle. There was no way I was going to. I look up on the wall and there's a Footprints poem. And the Footprints poem had meant something to our family because I had bought a bedspread with it for my oldest daughter when she had seen it at a fair. And I look up at the Footprints poem and my thought just turned to God, I'm screwed. And it wasn't any kind of a special prayer trying to accomplish anything. It was just like an acknowledgement. I'm screwed. That afternoon, a man came into the facility doing what he does, and he still does it today. He's like 34 years sober, 35 years sober. And he says, anybody want to go to a men's meeting with me? And I put my hand up, and I went with two other men, went to a men's meeting with them. And I don't remember what they said, but I do remember being welcomed. And I do remember laughter. And I do remember that maybe I laughed. Most importantly, that night, that Thursday night, I put my head on the pillow and I slept. And I don't remember how long it had been since I had slept without a substance, without passing out, without just absolutely expiring, and I slept. That following Saturday morning, a man came in doing an H&I panel. There were 36 of us in the facility. We're sitting just kind of like this in rows and chairs. He comes in. It's like September in Chandler. It's hot, and he's wearing a sports coat tie, and I think to myself, I wonder how much this guy's getting paid for this. And he said, because by now I'm about 6 or 7 days sober, and I'm getting things put together. And he says, if you're out there wondering how much I'm getting paid for this, I'm probably here to talk to you. And then he says, but you need to know, when I leave, I will have received a gift that I could never repay. And that's why I did it. He described, I'm here to tell you my story, because in telling you my story, I'm treating my alcoholism. And he told his story. He was 10 years sober at the time, and his story touched me much like the girl on that previous Thursday did. He was broken. He was despaired. He had broken up his family. He had done the kind of despicable things I could completely relate to. He described little men coming out of the vents, rappelling down to the floor. I related to everything he had to say. And he had more to talk about because he knew this stuff. He was standing up there doing the stuff that's described in step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening, we tried to carry this message. He was trying to carry the message, you know. And in doing so, he was treating his own alcoholism. But he started talking about getting a sponsor, becoming part of a group, going through the steps, working in the big book, having service commitments. You know, then he starts talking about reunited family and how his life had changed, how he got his career back, all that stuff. At the time, it was kind of like he was speaking Greek to me. And I didn't understand a thing he said, but I believed that what he was talking about worked for him. And I believed it so much because there was nothing left in me that the only choice I had was what I knew I could get, which was dead on my basement floor, or what he was talking about. In our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's chapter 3. There's a more about alcoholism chapter, and then there's some stories about some guys. There's one about Fred. He's an accountant. I could relate to that thing. He talks about his last drunk and how he was approached by two men who had outlined the spiritual answer they had found, the practical program of action necessary to implement the spiritual answer in their lives. And he says that once I made my mind up to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling my alcohol problem had been relieved, as it turned out to be. I didn't know that I was having the same kind of experience when I was listening to Terry, because when I made my mind up that without talking to anybody else, that I'm going to do what this man had just talked about. I had no idea where I was going to do it or how I was going to do it. I just knew I was going to do it. Thankfully, I believe that the power that I've come to understand or tried to understand, or the mystery that I can't understand, maybe is best said, opens the doors and unfolds life for me to facilitate those kinds of decisions. He didn't cure my alcoholism in that moment. What he did was gave me enough power so that I could have understanding and courage to take the next action that became aware for me. And what the next action ended up being was working with the spiritual advisor and writing a fourth step and then doing a fifth step with him and having an experience and an awareness of who I am. I was there for 28 days, and then I bought a place in Arizona because I'm not going to go back to Colorado Springs. My thinking was Colorado Springs is a problem. I'm going to stay down here. And they said, you know what, Mr. Phelan, you might want to consider staying in a more structured living environment for a period of time. So I ended up accepting. How I know God was working in my life was because I accepted their advice. I didn't argue it. I just said, okay, where should I go? And they gave me some options, and so I ended up in Dana Point, California. And I thought I was going to a place that had, the brochure showed a harbor and sailing boats. I didn't realize I was going to a four-bedroom house with 16 people. And it was perfect. And so before going there, I asked for some people's names who I might contact when I got out here. And so I write three names down in my pocket-sized big book because I knew I'd been going to meetings every day. And I started to hear some of the things you guys talk about in the meetings. And some of it's really good, you know, about especially the stuff about being connected with other people. I thought I knew how to be connected with other people. But my idea of being connected with other people is, can I use you? What are you good for? You know. I don't have any idea of how it is to be in a real human relationship. I don't even know how to be in a relationship with my own daughters. The way I dealt with my daughters was purely transactional. Their role in life was to provide me joy and happiness, and if they didn't do that properly, there was something wrong with them, and it needs to be fixed. That's no way for a human being to be in a relationship. And I start to hear about your experiences, how you put your lives back together, how your families came back together. And I started doing that thing. Anyway, I come out here to Dana Point. I get taken to a meeting in San Clemente. At this meeting, the first man that shares, this old black man, says, "Hello, my name is David Boot." I'm sorry, his name David B. I try not to use his last name to honor our traditions. He always uses his last name, but I recognize the name. I'm thinking, how do I know this man? I don't know. I opened my pocket-sized big book, and that was the first name God had me write down. And I went over to him after the meeting. I asked him if his number was this number. And he said, "Yep, that's my phone number." And I said, "I think I should talk to you." And I asked him to be my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor. You know, what's changed is we've both gotten older. And I think for me, he's shown me how it is to be a human, how it is to love other people. He went through some amazingly difficult things in sobriety, and he was always a beautiful example of joy and gratitude and humility, and he still is. I absolutely love that man to death. And with him, he launched me into the program. First thing he did was put me into a four-step workshop, and I did that, and my life changed. I ended up going back to Colorado, did 6 months in a correctional facility to deal with the issues of my past, came back here, and I just gave myself completely utterly abandon myself to this program. And what's happened in that is that, you know, I've been able to go through the issues of my daughter's getting married, one daughter going through her own story, and she's now got over 3 years sober. I don't know what the best way to end out with this is. Maybe I'll tell you what I'm doing today. I'm coming up on, I've just finished, came over 17 years sober. I'm coming in my 18th year. I ended up going back to school because I was attracted to some writings by a guy named Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung. Entered a PhD program up in Santa Barbara, and it's a mythological studies comparative religion PhD program. Because what I saw was, as I did all the readings, is how much of what we do is in all that other stuff. And so I embarked on a program. My concept paper has been accepted to write a dissertation on, and I'm on a leave of absence until April. But the dissertation is to demonstrate. I was just at a science and spirituality conference down in Florida where these brilliant quantum biologists, quantum physicists, spiritual masters were together because they're talking about the reconciliation of science and spirit. For a long time, they've been two different paths. You know, spirit and science have been, but what we're seeing is that there's a blending, that there's an energy in the middle of what's propelling, you know, being in its on its movement is some kind of what Bill called creative intelligence, spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things. So these things that he was touching on. But anyway, what I'm placing is the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step spiritual movement on the trajectory of the evolution of human consciousness, because human consciousness has developed, and something happened in 1934, 1935, 1936, which was major, because before that time frame, you never heard anybody saying, talking about higher power of my own understanding, God as you might understand him. It was always God as we have told you to understand him. Something broke through. So at this conference, what blew me away was there was not a speaker, and these guys were amazing, guys and gals were amazing, because they all at one point mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because they're alcoholics, but because they can see that there's something going on here. So if you're new here, my hope and my prayer for you tonight is that you can go tonight, go and put your head on your pillow and sleep. And that you might recognize that there's something that you have that nobody else has. That in your sobriety, in God working through you, that an authenticity will emerge that will come with a voice that can only be heard by some other person who is waiting to hear that voice. And if they don't get to hear the voice, they'll never hear the voice. And so we have a huge responsibility, every single one of us. And that's to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Seek to improve our conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves so that that real authenticity, that real perfect thing that's deep within every man, woman, and child can start to evolve, and make itself known. And how it gets made, makes it known, is when one alcoholic sits down with another alcoholic and shares their experience, strength, and hope, there's something there. There's an authenticity that awakens, and you can't get away from it. All you can definitely drown it, go back and drink. But when that thing starts to awaken, and if you let it come all the way out, when the other person hears the voice, you'll know it. You'll know that you've done your job, and then you go do that again, because that's what we're here for. Anyway, I'm going to close with this because Patty always closed with this. And I think this is an important thing. And Patty recently passed away, and I absolutely loved her. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now.